Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix.
But there's one thing, Alan, I've been wanting to ask you for years because I've been listening to you for a long time. How do you feel about George Orwell? Was he a good guy? Was he a bad guy? Was he one of us, one of them, or was he a mixture of both?
He had been brought up, of course, as a hereditary bureaucrat. Really, his family were bureaucrats, and he had a top position as a young man in Burma and other places as well, looking over massive plantations. Britain in his day, and people don't realize that Britain still ran the opium trade. It was all royal families, and the members of only royal families that were allowed, that were actually the owners of it. And his father ran the Burma Opium Company. This didn't come out. Nobody knew about it. They thought it was done away with in Britain until a politician called Thompson stood up in Parliament in the early 1920s and says, I just found out, but what's the British Opium Company? And when they opened it up, it was a crown corporation that only members of the royal family had shares in. And they're using the British taxpayer and their armies to police these things and make sure the plantations ran well. So Orwell took over from his father to an extent for a short period of time. Then he came back and he'd been trained to be a revolutionary in the same mode as the Cecil Rhodes group of expanding the British Empire for the greater good, etc., etc. And he went off, as you know, to fight in the Spanish War, Civil War. And he came back and talked in the socialist circles he'd talked to before, and the people turned their backs on him when he said that because they'd all been brainwashed to believe that communism was the same as socialism and for the working man's rights. He says, nothing to do with that whatsoever. They didn't want to hear that. He also said in one of his books that he couldn't understand why they kept wanting to push curse words and sexual curse words all through their writings. They wanted the right to do this back then. And he said no. He says, why degrade society? Then he caught on that the whole agenda they were getting paid for was to totally degrade society, to inherently destroy it and bring in a new society. So he did turn against them towards the end, and he did come out with 1984 to explain what that was all about, plus Animal Farm, which is excellent when you actually read the book. Don't bore with the cartoon stuff. Read the book. Because he shows you all the cons they use with the use of terminology and changing terminology gradually, etc., and you don't even notice it's happened. But he went off to an island off Scotland eventually as a recluse. He was paranoid at the time that the group that he used to work for were going to come and kill him, including their communist branches as well, because they ran all sides from the Royal Institute for International Affairs, by the way. And he went down to meet the boat every other week or month when it came in to watch whoever came off it, because he was absolutely certain they were going to try to kill him. And this was kind of verified to an extent, because he had tuberculosis, and when he ended up in hospital, almost a closed shop type hospital, his friends had to rescue him because he was dying in the hospital, because they were giving him the streptomycin without the supplementary drug that must go with it. If you don't get the drug with it, you can die very quickly from these intramuscular streptomycin injections and hemorrhaging and so on. So they pulled him out to save his life. So he had turned against them in the end, for sure. Yeah.
George Orwell talked about this ability to control vast herds of people in his book 1984. The reason he could talk about this and understand it so well was he had been selected to work and even fight physically for world socialism. He was a member of a long lineage of bureaucrats, high-level bureaucrats for Britain. His father was in charge of the Burma Opium Company for the royal family, who owned it in the 1930s, and he had a very good education in university, the Ivy League type. He fought in Spain in the Civil War there, and when he came back, he went around the social circuits telling the people they'd all been conned, been fooled, and that world socialism was a big lie, and it was vastly different from the communism, as we've been taught it was so similar too. And then all the lefties turned against him. He was given a job in the BBC during World War II in the Department of Propaganda. That's how he learned the skills of propaganda. And his job, literally, he said himself, was to convince the average housewife that the junk they were getting as meat and food, because the rationing in World War II was actually healthier for them and better for them. And they told him how to make new recipes up. In other words, we were changing reality, completely changing reality. And, of course, he met many of the other levels of propaganda that was running Britain at that time. And he realized that everything was distortion of perception, and it was all deliberate. He coined the terms doublethink, which is to know and not to know at the same time. To be conscious of complete truthfulness while telling carefully constructed lies, that's what bureaucrats and politicians do. You're conscious of complete truthfulness, but you tell carefully constructed lies. To hold simultaneously two opinions which cancelled each other out, knowing them to be contradictory and believing in both of them. We hear that all the time too. To use logic against logic, to repudiate morality while laying claim to it. They're always pretending they're so moral in their speeches. But we always see what they're really doing. And yet, they'll still stand up for what they say, not for what they do. Remember what Toynbee said, we always refute with our mouth that which we do with our hands.
And again, the strange phenomena, which again came out of the same group, Royal Institute for International Affairs, the World Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, the IMF, and all the other power structures we have across the planet, all the central banking system, and technocrats, of course, from technocracy, that are appointed over everything. This is what technocracy really was to be about, appointing people over social control systems. And money is a social control system, and the lack of it is too. you soon realize that, don't you, when you don't have any. But it's also a tremendous power policy, because those who lend the money can deny it in any country across the world. When even if they're starving or in famine or whatever, it can be denied unless they accept specific social policies that are mandated to them along with the loan. It's power, isn't it? It's all power. But again, that's what George Orwell knew. He fought on the socialist side in the Spanish War, and he caught on what they thought were the brothers that they had, because the propaganda in Britain was awfully good. Their brothers were the communists that were coming in, and when he realized what the communists were really like, he eventually was hunted, and he got out just in time, because there was assassinating competition. They didn't want what they call British type socialism. They wanted their own communism running the world, basically. That's the idea behind it at the time. So he escaped it, but he understood the dangers of even socialism. And when he got back and told them what was happening in the socialist clubs in Britain, they turned their back on him. He'd been a hero beforehand, and now they turned their back, because he literally showed a different side of it than had been informed to the public. And they really didn't like that. And they also complained that even right in you find so many academic writings about Blair-Orwell, right, and Huxley too, in universities, because they're always churning out more philosophers or whatever it happens to be, or different world manager types, really, who all do their little papers on these people of the past. And they're forever, ever breaking down the enigma of Orwell, because he wouldn't go along with the open sexual new morality of the socialism that they wanted, the abandon, the old idea that H.G. Wells was about, what was free love everywhere, and the state would take care of the problems. But Orwell wasn't for that. He still had clung to a traditional form of having a mate and family and all that kind of stuff. So they thought that was just terrible. In other words, he wasn't a true socialist, or he'd be the same, you see. That's what they thought. So they try to pick and pick and pick, if you just don't conform completely to what they want. It's never changed. But you'll find the same. You don't need the terms, even in academia, of people saying they're a socialist. You can tell by the fact they're going along with it. All the whole world agenda is to be controlled by experts. And they decide what an expert is. And they can also decide what a problem is to have the experts. Yeah, well, it's a problem. We need experts for this problem. So they create what, or they say they create the problems, and that's it. And it's just too easy to propagandize their agenda without ever explaining to the public the other side. There's always a side of everything. On the other side, you have George Orwell, Blair, who himself had been. What would you call him, really? He invaded another country, Spain, with other groups to overthrow the governments, only to find out that the communist faction that he thought was their friends of socialists had other ideas and had eventually had him marked down for assassination, because Orwell himself, or Blair, they tested him out. Communists always test people out, and if they're good, strong speakers, etc., and they have enough communist tendencies and stick to the rule book, they can use them. But if the person has the same ability to speak and can attract people and sway people's minds, but isn't totally on board with the total communistic agenda, then he will be an enemy. So they don't wait to see it happening. They eliminate them first. So he was marked down for elimination, and that's when he managed to get out of Spain. When he got tipped off, they were after him. George Orwell's 1984. Who are we at war today with? Who's the enemy today? Is they change their gun sights all the time, back and forth, until you're lost. But behind it all is always profit for big corporations. Always. Always, always, always. You know, there's a whole bunch of wartime scenario. I was watching some old propaganda stuff from Britain, an old disc I have there with documentaries of propaganda from World War II on rationing. It was really interesting. And they show you know, 2 ounces of butter for a person a week. That's what you got there, 2 ounces of butter. And a bit of meat that you could have probably measured about the size of your thumb at times, you know, starvation diet. That was the white privilege by them. But where folk into the 50s, 1960s had rickets, the children, working class, of course. But it said here, this is article here says, and they're giving the same, see, they're giving the same propaganda, how to cook this and how to do that. The same stuff that George Orwell talked about, because he had a show on the BBC radio during the war, and he said, I used to have to try and convince the public that previously discarded items of food and certain beef and things like that, things were thought unfit for human consumption. You had to convince them that this is the best food they ever had. And they put out articles saying that the people in Britain had never been healthier. I was watching it last night. It's quite fascinating. And that's what you're seeing again. Is they unroll the same trash and the same recipes to you to make you. And then they'll come out and say, you've never been fitter than you are today, you know, as you watch all these different diseases come back again and your bones start to go wonky in the children's legs, etc. And they'll keep telling you how wonderful it is. Same kind of thing, same rubbish. George Orwell talks about it. Now, George Orwell is a mysterious man because he belonged to the upper middle class in an intergenerational family of workers for the what they called the imperial system at that time, the British imperial system. And he also was trained in this strange progressive, they call it progressiveness, for instance, for those who don't quite understand it. Most folk can say all the time, but don't really understand what they mean. To be progressive, you must be progressing towards something that's already drafted out to be coherent and meaningful. But it's never told to the public what they mean by that. When the upper middle class are for it, you got to stop and think a minute here. The whole idea of managing the general population, the so-called working class types, called the proles by George Orwell from the proletariat, basically. He mentioned in his book 1984, that was published in 1948. And although the original title of the book that he wanted was The Last Man, meaning the last sentient human being who tried to put the little bits that he knew into action in a very, very small scale and suffered the consequences. The idea being, as O'Brien, who tortures him, says in the story, he says, if you were a man, Winston, then you were the last man. The idea that through scientific techniques and massive data collection and so on every single individual, constantly, they would know who would be a problem before it even became a problem and they deal with it. That's pretty well where we are today, isn't it? And there's a little bit of a spat between Orwell and Aldous Huxley. Huxley, long before, in the 1930s, 1933, I think it was, came up with Brave New World, where he had less of a totalitarian system being overt. It used more covert means to manipulate the people who were already genetically modified into the division of labor from the very top, who were alphas and so alpha pluses and all that, right down to the bottom level of the workers. So they're designed for the particular work they'd have to do. That's not far-fetched at all, because that's where we're going. The spat between Orwell and Huxley was really that Orwell was shaped by the big totalitarian movements of his day, the overtly totalitarian movements like the communist or Bolshevik revolution, which turned into the Soviet system, communism, where democracy was abolished altogether, although they often call themselves the free and democratic state of so-and-so. There was no real democracy there. It was run by the dictatorship of the proletariat, which meant you had a dictator on top of you rather than off the people. It was a dictatorship over the people. And of course, the 1920s and 30s into the 40s was full of that kind of stuff. The whole idea that the elite were on board with totalitarianism and the supposed opposition of the elite, which is to work together in tandem with Hegelian dialectic to get the same goals achieved. The technique was to use revolution and running the takeover and put experts in to run the world properly. That's never gone away. Today it's dressed up in business suits. It's given fancy titles with the United Nations, things like that. But it's still as strong today as it ever was. People can't recognize it simply because they don't wear the uniforms when you come on television as your prime minister or your president. You don't see yourselves or think of yourselves as being brainwashed because it's constantly drummed into you. You live in a free society. And yet you've been through the indoctrination process of the social engineering through the school system, which teaches you about special categories of people and which ones are higher than other ones. And you have to be a new minority to get special status, you see. Which is rather good for the opportunist because he or she will realize that they get priority hiring down the road if you simply join the right band, you see, and declare your this or that or whatever it happens to be trendy at the time. So there are many, many different facets to all of this, but getting back to the system, again, the system is totalitarian, and it's a much more easygoing totalitarianism. We think, of course, we think so, because you don't see the henchmen coming in Brave New World or even in George Orwell's 1984. You don't see them coming smashing your door down, except maybe in the States sometimes under the guise of drug raids and so on. But you don't see them coming into your house because you've said something wrong. That's maybe happening now, actually, with all the politically correct people around there and all the mandates of what you can say and what you can't say, what you can think and what you can't think. Because now it's going down to forbidding you to think about things. Who knows where it might lead, eh? A thought could lead you off to who knows where, eh? Upset the apple cart. So anyway, where's this all going? Well, let's go back again to George Orwell, shall we? And Orwell wrote a book, wrote a letter, I should say, to Noel Wilmot in 1944. He says, many thanks for your letter. You ask whether totalitarianism leader worship, etc. And that's what the totalitarian is. I don't care if it's been put across by the big star superstar creating mechanism and machinery for politicians that wear business suits or even casuals. And that's how they brought his dad out, Trudeau's dad, at one time with his big wide-brimmed hat. He was a new trendy type of leader for the era. And it doesn't matter, as long as it's not uniform, you see. So anyway, whether totalitarianism, leader worship, etc. are really on the upgrade in instance, the fact that they are not apparently growing in this country and the USA. This is during World War II. He said, I must say I believe or fear that taking the world as a whole, these things are on the increase. Hitler, no doubt, will soon disappear. They knew that back then. But only at the expense of strengthening A, Stalin, the Soviet communist totalitarian state, B, the Anglo-American millionaires, and C, all sorts of petty furors of the type of de Gaulle, that was General de Gaulle of France. All the national movements everywhere, even those that originate in resistance to the German domination, seem to take non-democratic forms, to group themselves around some superhuman Führer, such as Hitler, Stalin, Salazar, Franco, Gandhi, De Valera of Ireland. They're all varying examples. That's what they're doing. The press was really building them up into superstar status, all the dictators, and to adopt the theory that the end justifies the means. That still runs true today. You're not running under democracy. You're simply brainwashed that you are. Everywhere the world movement seems to be in the direction of centralized economies which can be made to work, in quotation marks, in an economic sense, but which are not democratically organized, and which tend to establish a caste system. Caste system's a class system, you see. With this go the horrors of emotional nationalism and the tendency to disbelieve in the existence of objective truth, because all the facts we have to fit in with the words and prophecies of some infallible Führer. Already history has in a sense ceased to exist. That is, there's no such thing as a history of our own times which could be universally accepted. And the exact sciences are endangered as soon as the military necessity ceases to keep people up to the mark. Hitler can say that the Jews started the war, and if he survives, that will become official history. He can't say that 2 and 2 are 5, because for the purposes of, say, ballistics, they have to make 4. But if the sort of world that I am afraid of arrives, a world of 2 or 3 great superstates which are unable to conquer one another, 2 and 2 could become 5 if the Führer wished it. That, so far as I can see, is the direction in which we're actually moving, though, of course, the process is reversible. As to the comparative immunity of Britain and the USA, whatever the pacifists, etc. may say, we have not gone totalitarian yet. And this is a very hopeful symptom. I believe very deeply, as I've explained in my book, The Lion and the Unicorn, in the English people, and in their capacity to centralize their economy without destroying freedom in doing so. But one must remember that Britain and the USA haven't been really tried. They haven't known defeat or severe suffering. And there are some bad symptoms to balance the good ones. To begin with, there's the general indifference to the decay of democracy. This is back in World War II. Do you realize, for instance, that no one in England under 26 years of age now has a vote? And that so far as one can see, the great mass of people of that age don't give a damn for this. You think the techniques of keeping us dumb and stupid and indifferent are new? Of course they're not. They've been used. But things that work are never tossed out by those who rule. And most folk are still liberals in every age, you see. They're kept worrying and scurrying and having the occasional beer in the pub or wherever it happens to be and they feel they're alive, yada yada, and they don't really know what's going on. And as they're up to the age of 30, they're simply chasing sex, sex, sex today more so than ever. And they're encouraged that way. It's been created for them to do so. Anyway, so secondly, there's the fact that the intellectuals are more, now this is very important, Secondly, there is the fact, and remember I told you many, many times, that on board in the scientific system to run ours at all are the intellectuals and intelligentsia and universities and so on. It's the fact that the intellectuals are more totalitarian in outlook than the common people. On the whole, the English intelligentsia have opposed Hitler, but only at the price of accepting Stalin. Most of them are perfectly ready for dictatorial methods, secret police, systematic falsification of history, that's happening all the time now, as long as they feel that it is on our side. Indeed, the statement that we haven't a fascist movement in England largely means that the young at this moment look for their Führer elsewhere. One can't be sure that won't change, or one can't be sure the common people won't think 10 years hence, as the intellectuals do now. I hope they won't, even trust they won't, but if so, it will be at the cost of a struggle. If one simply proclaims that all is for the best and doesn't point to the sinister symptoms, one is merely helping to bring totalitarianism nearer. And he goes on to talk about, he says, you also ask if I think the world tendency is towards fascism. Why do I support the war? It's a choice of evils. I fancy nearly every war is that, a choice of evils. I know enough of British imperialism not to like it, but I would support it against Nazism or Japanese imperialism as a lesser evil. Similarly, I would support the USSR against Germany because I think the USSR cannot altogether escape its past and retains enough of the original ideas of the revolution to make it a more hopeful phenomenon than Nazi Germany. I think and have thought ever since the war began in 1936 or thereabouts that our cause is the better, but we have to keep on making it the better, which involves constant criticism. So you glean little bits of what he knew back then, that the intelligentsia are on board with basically this whole totalitarian form of governing, not just the people of one country, but the planet, you see. And there's only one system runs the world and runs all the different parties and plays the game, you see, on us. And when you go through that too, you find out that how many folk knew that you couldn't vote in Britain back in 1944 until you were 26 years of age. And again, it's talking about the memory hole for history, how they keep changing it. All you hear is from, again, most folk get their what they think is history from the History Channel nonsense, totally updated for the times we're living in today, or in movies, and they think it was all about suffragettes. They think, oh, but they got the vote for women long, long before, oh, you know, and here you go. So it just shows you how misinformed we really are. And then you go into this, you see. We talk about Orwell and Huxley. Now, this next letter, basically, is to George Orwell from Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley used to be his French teacher, in fact, at Eton. And he wrote Brave New World. Actually, it was 1931 that came out. So he had a different look on how we could be all cajoled and guided into this new system of totalitarianism, whereas George Orwell still saw the totalitarian movements, the massive armies and uniforms and uniform leaders and so on. So he disagreed with how it could be brought in, this whole system. And in reality, I think they were both right, because during this war on terror, which has taken away the rights of almost everybody, and given the government gave itself the rights to spy on all of us all the time, because you're under a totally controlled society as never before. Everyone must be completely predictable, and that's where everything's electronic. It's updated every day by you, and the big boys have got complete personality, daily profiles updated on you by yourself. So you're predictable. Anyway, here's the letter from Huxley. It says Huxley starts off the letter praising the book to Orwell, describing it as profoundly important. He continues that the philosophy of the ruling minority in 1984 is a sadism which has been carried to its logical conclusion by going beyond sex and denying it. Then Huxley switches gears and criticizes the book writing. Whether in actual fact the policy of the boot on the face can go on indefinitely seems doubtful. My own belief is that the ruling oligarchy will find less arduous and wasteful ways of governing and of satisfying its lust for power. And these ways will resemble those which I describe in Brave New World. Basically, while praising 1984, Huxley argues that his version of the future was more likely to come to pass. And so that you wouldn't, by scientific means, you see. It won't be the boot standing on your face forever and stomping you forever. It'll be a kind of a nice furry moccasin or something, you see. And you won't recognize it as such for what it really is. Still, this, in other words, the intent is just the same, and the results are even more efficient, because you cooperate then, you see. In Huxley's seemingly dystopic world state, the elite amuse the masses into submission. That's a very good expression, massive entertainment and so on, with a mind-numbing drug as well called Soma, and an endless buffet of casual sex. Does that ring a bell, eh? Orwell's Oceana, on the other hand, keeps the masses in check with fear, thanks to an endless war, like war forever, under terrorism, and a hyper-competent surveillance state. At first blush, they might seem like they're diametrically opposed, but in fact, an Orwellian world and a Huxleyan one are simply two different modes of oppression. But actually, they're combined at the moment, before they go into the complete invisible one. You see. Obviously, we are nowhere near dystopic version, but the power of both books is that they tap into our fears of the state. While Huxley might make you look askance at The Bachelor or Facebook, Orwell makes you recon horror at the government throwing around phrases like enhanced interrogation and surgical drone strikes. And I'll put the link up for that too. Actually, the whole letter to Orwell is awfully good. Actually, I will read the letter because it's too interesting. So it was very kind of you to tell your publishers to send me a copy of your book. It arrived as I was in the midst of a piece of work that required much reading and consulting of references. And since poor sight makes it necessary for me to ration my reading, I had to wait a long time before being able to embark on 1984. Agreeing with all that the critics have written of it, I need not tell you yet once more how fine and profoundly important the book is. May I speak instead of the thing with which the book deals? Now listen to this too. This is from Aldous Huxley. The ultimate revolution. Now, don't forget that. The first hints of a philosophy of the ultimate revolution. The revolution which lies beyond politics and economics, and which aims at total subversion of the individual psychology and physiology, are to be found in the Marquis de Sade, who regarded himself as the continuator or the consummator of Robespierre. And Babouf. The philosophy of the ruling minority in 1984 is a sadism which has been carried to its logical conclusion by going beyond sex and denying it. And he goes on to the boot in the face and so on. My own belief is that the ruling oligarchy will find less arduous and wasteful ways of governing and of satisfying its lust for power. And these ways will resemble those which I described in Brave New World. I have had occasion recently to look into the history of animal magnetism. He's talking about hypnosis and so on. And how to indoctrinate people through even sleep and so on. It's much like the depatterning and so on. It was carried out by Cameron in Canada at the time, which got a lot of press later on, of course. That was MK Ultra, of course. And he says, I have been greatly struck by the way in which for 150 years The world has refused to take serious cognizance of the discoveries of Mesmer, Braid, Esdaile and the rest, partly because of the prevailing materialism and partly because of prevailing respectability. 19th century philosophers and men of science were not willing to investigate the odder facts of psychology for practical men, such as politicians, soldiers and policemen, to apply in the field of government. Thanks to the voluntary ignorance of our fathers, the advent of the ultimate revolution was delayed for five or six generations. And that's what they mean by that, that ultimate revolution is total submission by the people who have been totally brought into a psychological and behavioural way of managing them all. You know, political correctness. Another lucky accident was Freud's inability to hypnotize successfully and his consequent disparagement of hypnotism. This delayed the general application of hypnotism to psychiatry for at least 40 years, but now psychoanalysis has been combined with hypnosis, and hypnosis has been made easy and indefinitely extensible through the use of barbiturate drugs, which induce a hypnoid and suggestible state in even the most recalcitrant subjects. Now remember too, that this is a very old letter, and he knew of people who were testing other means of altering what we think and through the brain. In Tavistock, for instance, he talks about that much later, not in this letter, where they actually put wires and electrodes in folks' brains. And then you had Delgado as well, doing it remotely by implants. And this famous one was a bull, and of course, but he was actually doing it with people too, with men, prisoners and so on, and some from the military. So, and now, of course, we have Brzezinski yapping in the 1970s and the technotronic era between two ages and so on, the technotronic era chapter of how electromagnetic signals can pulse through the air, will affect the moods of people and control behavior and so on. Wi-Fi is everywhere now. Essays with the next generation believe that the world's rulers will discover that infant conditioning, well, that's already here, it's done totally, and narco-hypnosis are more efficient as instruments of government than clubs and prisons, and that the lust for power can be just as completely satisfied by suggesting people, suggestion, you see, into loving their servitude as by flogging and kicking them into obedience. In other words, I feel that the nightmare of 1984 is destined to modulate into the nightmare of a world having more resemblance to that which I imagined in Brave New World. The change will be brought about as a result of a felt need for increased efficiency. Meanwhile, of course, there may be a large-scale biological and atomic war, in which case we'll have nightmares of other and scarcely imaginable kinds. So, just reading the letters and exchanges from people who were in, who mixed with an upper elite and who got lots of information and gossip at dinner tables and so on from the upper elites and all the different parties they attended. They knew a lot more, especially Huxley perhaps, in what was really being planned. From myself, Alan Watt, this good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.